You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest on this hour is Micah Green. Micah, it's good to have you here this morning.
Great to be here.
So Micah, the question we start with is a big question, but it's an opening. It's a start and not a definition. But who are you? What are some of the things we need to know about you to start this conversation?
Yeah, for sure. That's a big question. So I would say I'm a mix between an entrepreneur, a college dropout, a windsurfer, skateboarder.
and wow. So that was really fast. Can you slow down a little bit on that and kind of break those pieces out a little bit?
Yeah, definitely.
Sure.
So on the entrepreneur side, which kind of ties to the college dropout, and also people, you know, say college dropout, but a stopout is someone who hasn't dropped out, but who's focusing on a project and typically entrepreneurial,
right.
So business and basically working on it full time because, you know, very passionate about it, very excited.
Sure.
So right now working on the robotics company MadeBot, and I would say I'm entrepreneurial because I've started multiple companies a lot smaller scale before, but it's just really exciting. I love making stuff, building stuff from nothing, and getting people to say that it's useful to them and something they want. So
that's totally cool. And some of the other things that you listed in that skater, you know, surfer, what else?
Yeah, definitely. I love the outdoors. And typically, I guess you could say, entrepreneurs might not always necessarily be skaters and windsurfers. So it's a little different, but I love the outdoors. I think it's very therapeutic. I think that's why I'm so in love with it. And another thing that I do is music, so composing electronic music, and that is also very therapeutic. And it's just, you know, it's time alone and time to really, like, think about things in a different way, I guess, not rushed. And it's meditative to me.
Yeah.
And also I meditate too, which is very meditative.
Yeah. And also, what you closed with was a teenager.
Yeah.
And so how old are you?
I'm 19 years old.
Okay. And wow, you hold on to a lot of pieces of a life that, you know, some folks might have a hard time managing emotionally or intellectually, all those pieces, but they seem to work for you.
Yeah, I think the key is that there has to be that balance, right? Like the side that I love every aspect of it, but, you know, the work side is obviously very, very intense at times and takes a while, you know, working all the time, many hours. So, you know, these other things, like I said, they're very therapeutic. And I think part of that is just, or most of it is because, you know, to balance off and to kind of step away from that and, you know, get a different perspective, slow down a bit.
I'm gonna wanna explore how you figured this out, but let's go to some music. What would you like to start with?
Let's go ahead with Tame Impala. Let It Happen.
Okay.
One of my favorite songs, if not my favorite right now.
Thank you.
And that was Tame Impala and Let It Happen. And you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. And this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Micah Green. So, Micah, you made the comment that, you know, while you're 19 years old and you started a major startup, but you've been an entrepreneur from very early on.
Yeah, I was cursed.
okay. But just, you know, maybe even before that, you know, where did you grow up? What did you do? What caught your attention? You know, and maybe, you know, what are the ties to entrepreneurship? But also just, you know, you have a fascinating, very condensed life story.
Yeah. So I grew up in the D.C. area.
Uh-huh.
And I had two siblings. I was the youngest as a baby, so definitely spoiled out of the three. Didn't mind that too much. But yeah, I think a big part about, I mean, more than just entrepreneurship, but like even now, you know, having these different interests and, you know, trying to balance it in different ways, it was really about having different experiences. And my parents pushed that a ton, you know, whether it would be going to different countries. So, you know, all of the siblings were, I wouldn't say forced because we all wanted to, but we had to go to
strongly
encouraged to go to South America for the summer and live with a host family for uh-huh. every year. And I think that was for at least 5-6 years each. So,
wow.
So that was huge. And it was really to open our eyes. So I think we know what song we'll play next.
okay.
And then, you know, it just was to get different experiences, different perspectives. And, it was amazing. It definitely opened our eyes and really gave us a different viewpoint of the world because we did live in a very sheltered community. It was a suburb right outside DC. It was very, very, you know, sheltered and safe bubble. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to expose ourselves beyond that. And in terms of the experiences outside of, you know, doing that travel, it was really, it came down to, you know, the sports or hobbies that we did. So, I did Taekwondo. I actually was a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
I was an actor. I got an agent for a couple of years, which was great, doing like little commercials and stuff like that. And then I'm trying to think what other things. I mean, really, it was just, you know, changing up, of course, the soccer when I was younger.
And sure.
The typical American boy stuff. But yeah, I think it was just pushing a lot of different experiences onto us and, you know, also wanting to, being receptive. And then starting things like fencing also as I got a little older. And my brother was really into speed skating, so we did that. And I think we're a weird family in the sense that we don't kind of follow the norm, so we weren't like the lacrosse football players necessarily, you know.
Right. I mean, yeah, it sounds like you came from a certain amount of privilege, but your activities weren't about status, they were about experience.
Yeah.
And that's a huge difference.
Yeah,
that's definitely a huge difference.
Definitely. So, and I loved it. I mean, it definitely, you know, connecting the dots, it helps you connect the dots in different ways and get different perspectives. Again, whether it's, you know, from fencing that might affect school or might affect the dance side,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All of that. And then, so I think a really pivotal point in my life was really when I moved to California for a year. So my dad took a sabbatical at UC Berkeley, and we lived there for literally just a year. I didn't want to go. I hated the idea. I said, I have all my friends here. I'll stay back. Don't worry. You guys go. I'll take care of the house. I'll take care of the dogs. And everything was great. But then I got there and I didn't want to leave. So I think it really, again,
how
it
old
gave,
were you?
I was in eighth grade, so I was 13 years old.
Yeah.
So that, again, gave me a very different perspective. And in my eyes, perspective is like life. I think that's a huge part of it. You know, stepping in other people's shoes are really hard to do, and it's inherently something we don't do. But being able to do that and even just, you know, explore the world traveling, I think is like the best gift my parents could have ever given us.
Yeah.
So being in California, I was outside of that bubble again. So it was really in an environment that we've never been used to. It was in the sense that we could walk everywhere. We could bike everywhere.
Right.
We were very, very independent because of that. Whereas, you know, back home, it was like everyone would have to drive us and, you know, we'd have to wait on people, always like calling, texting, that sort of stuff. And also being in California, it didn't hurt on the outdoor side. So I was just spending more time outdoors, hanging out with people. And it also put me in an uncomfortable position in the sense that I had to make new friends again. I had to set up a new life, temporary life. I knew that I was leaving too.
Right.
And eventually I didn't want to, but pretty quickly I realized I didn't want to, but we knew we had to go back. So really, really, I think it was just the fact that, you know, putting us in that new position just completely like shifted my mindset and gave me a much more open viewpoint.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. It also seems that it taught that you can exercise your heart muscle, which means you can let go of things you love for a time, and you can love things that you know you're going to have to let go for good.
Yep. Except Mocha. She was... it was tough leaving the ducks.
Yeah. And that is a lesson that many people don't learn ever, because mm-hmm. it's very hard to learn that. So I'm just fascinated by the idea that the way you add up your experiences is the ability to take multiple perspectives, and many of us are kind of generally open to that in a linear fashion, but what makes it really useful is when you can do it simultaneously, and then it puts you in a position of having to feel and know and physically react to many different things all at once, mm-hmm. and that is something that many people don't feel up to, but it seems like that was a part of your upbringing, whether it was intended or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I was thinking about this yesterday too. I was thinking, like, what if I didn't do some of this stuff? You know, like, I mean, windsurfing and longboarding, that sort of stuff is a lot less so now. You know, it's more the therapeutic side. But if I like was just in school doing school, how bored I would be, and just doing like one thing. I do like to do a lot of things, and I think because of my childhood, that's kind of spoiled me, and now for the rest of my life I don't think I'll be able to just focus on one thing.
Right, and I don't, and most people don't have the luxury of focusing on one thing. It's just not possible, because even though they may be in a certain sense caught up in a school system, they are things that they have to deal with their families, or things mm-hmm. that they have to deal with others in their life, and it's just we often don't set the goal as being able to be comfortable with many and competing things and contradictory things. But when you set that goal, it seems satisfying mm-hmm. to you. How does entrepreneurship kind of cut into this stuff?
Yeah, I think really it's the fact that if you define entrepreneurship and not look by the dictionary, but in my eyes, it's really starting something from nothing and doing a lot of different elements to bring something together. So I think that actually is kind of an umbrella of my life in a sense, that it's the same idea, starting different things from nothing, even without much background, and then managing a way to try and put them together, at least balancing that. So.
And so what are some of the things that you have done entrepreneurially?
Okay. So when I was 7, this was mainly using my cuteness factor, I got some stuff out of my basement. So broken Frisbees, there's like magnetic, like flashing lights, like random stuff that no one wants. And went around my neighborhood, started selling it to people. Of course, again, it was due to my cuteness factor, not the product. You got to be a good salesperson if you can sell something no one wants. So it was a great lesson.
If you can sell a broken Frisbee.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So I made a good $3 that day. It was very exciting. And then started different things. So never did like the standard lemonade stand, but I resold high-end headphones in high school. And that was actually cut off by the vice principal and my dad because it wasn't necessarily ethical, I guess you could say.
The resale process?
Yeah. I mean, I was making good money.
Right.
And it was also, I mean, legally, I'm not allowed to sell anything
in school property.
Sure.
Yeah, but you're trying to kind of push the boundaries. Why do you sell? Why do you want to sell stuff?
I was cursed. It's in my blood. I said it was cursed. It's in my blood. My mom is, she has started multiple companies and is amazing, if not the best salesperson I know. Brother is the same way. Sister and dad are definitely not. They're the opposite. Uh-huh. They're like more the science side. Really, deep, like thought provoking, but less salesy. So I would say I focus, or like I've gotten it from my mom and my brother a little. And I don't know, there's just something exciting about, I think, and I was talking to one of my mentors yesterday, actually, and I said, like my number one job as CEO right now is to get people pumped and just stoked about MadeBot and what we're doing. Uh-huh. And I have to do that to investors, to potential investors, to our team, to our advisors, so they want to stay our advisors, and to people we might, you know, want to hire.
Sure.
So I think it's just really fun to convince people and, you know, use your persuasion to, you know, build something, do something for the greater, not, you know, for me so I can get money in the bank, but for, you know, the whole company, for the whole group. And like, it's just a nice to have like this community and really building something up. And part of that process is sales.
Right.
So I feel like I'm always selling, even when I'm not selling. And mm-hmm. It's just part of the job. And that's one of the best parts of the job. So.
Right, right. And what is the experience you have in terms of pumping people up or selling a product? What does that do for you? What does it do for them? What is your longer term relationship?
Yeah. So I would say that it just creates, like I said, kind of that community mm-hmm. sense. And, you know, there's this greater good, there's this greater vision, this mission that we're all on together. And the idea that, you know, I was kind of the start, the pioneer in this vision, or at least in this movement, right. Is just amazing. It's, you know, like with any leadership, having people follow you and having more people come, and like with presidential candidates too, you know, they have millions of people who are supporting them and that sort of stuff. So can't even imagine what that would feel like. But even, you know, five people like on right. our team now. And when I see people wear this jacket, like our MadeBot jacket, it gets me like warm and fuzzy inside because, uh-huh, uh-huh. you know, they love what they're doing. And it's something that they all feel, and we all feel will have a great impact. So
what is MadeBot?
Good question. A robotics company on a mission to revolutionize the hospitality industry. So really we're creating cleaning robots, and our goal is Rosie the Robot from the Jetsons.
Okay.
You laugh now.
No. I get it. So you want to basically eliminate jobs that are repetitive by turning that over to a robot, which is not necessarily, it's a good thing, but you also want to create a service which does a more reliable job, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't say our goal is at all to like replace jobs or anything, and especially with the product we're working on now, it's more as like an assistant or augmentation.
Right, and most mechanization, and this is historically for hundreds of years, most mechanization has been an augmentation, and then it's tended to replace the most repetitive, and so, in some cases the most dangerous.
Yeah, exactly.
Of work, and that's not, and so I'm trying to walk a fine line of realizing that you're in a dicey spot.
Yeah, it is. It's a controversial area. And I mean, people say, the robotics experts say robots are best for tasks that are dull or repetitive, dirty or dangerous. So the nice thing is what we're focused on encompasses all those things. But I mean, whenever people push back, you just look at all of history and look at where we're at today. Mm-hmm. And think about a very simple example. I saw this panel once, and this guy, I love this example. Back in the day, we used our fingernails to dig up dirt, to dig holes.
Yeah,
then
yeah.
someone found a stick.
Yeah.
So then from the 10 people that it took, or let's say 100 people that it took to dig up that one hole with their fingers, now you need 10 people with sticks.
Right.
And then someone said, oh, let's make a shovel out of this stick. And, you know, so I don't have to go the whole way through.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
And then now we have these giant bulldozers, so it's like one per. So, you know, throughout history, that's been just a very common case. And it's extremely helpful because now people can focus on more creative and enjoyable activities.
Right. And also ask, you know, what is it that's important that we do?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we compensate those who do it, as opposed, and in addition to provide the technology that assists us in doing it. It allows us to frame the question in a bigger way without minimizing anybody's role.
Yeah, and you know, part of that is like, what can us as humans, the smartest creatures, animals on earth, do that a machine or, you know, robot or other things can't do? And that's what we should be focusing on.
Right. How did you I think you want to go to the next song is Open Your Eyes. Well, how did your eyes get open to the MadeBot idea? How did you become aware of this as something you might pursue?
Yeah. So I'd say it's a little bit of two parts. So one is, I actually did have a housekeeper back in throughout the time that I was home. She's like a babysitter and basically like a second mom to me. And
yeah,
she a actually
little, something more than a nanny.
Yeah, definitely. No, yeah. She's super close. We're still close, and I love her very much. So one thing that we saw is, you know, she got injured a lot actually from the job. It's very it's repetitive again, and it's dangerous. Like, it's actually very dangerous. So part of that was, you know, that came up. And then the other side was actually at the hotel school, we have to work as a room attendant or a housekeeper.
Sure.
So very quick story, worked there and realized that there are definitely many uses for automation and augmentation of some of these tasks.
Sure. Sure. And but I guess how did that, you know, the realization of the need, how did that come to this highly, you know, incredibly sophisticated technology? How did you make those connections?
Yeah, so actually at first I wanted to make a robot that could make beds. And I was so stoked and couldn't wait to get going with that and then get one for me. And then it turned out that that was going to cost millions of dollars and take many, many years. So it didn't seem like the best way to get our foot in the door, especially because this is like right at the cusp. So we looked at other areas and then decided to focus on the floors, and it seemed like a great way to start. People were excited, potential customers were still very excited. And again, it's still that idea that this isn't a Rosie the robot, scary, you know, I'm going to take your job robot.
Right.
It's an assistant. It's a little cute assistant that helps. So it's, you know, part of this is more than just proving out the technology, it's proving out the social acceptance.
Right.
And again, like what we were just talking about, it's the idea that not everyone is receptive yet, but we're getting into that point, and it's slowly coming because we do, you know, the argument is that yes, it takes jobs, it's going to hurt the economy, but in reality what it does is it pushes society forward, and it really gets people focusing on more important, more
or it can
creative.
It can. Yeah. And none of these things are inevitable, either the negatives or the positives. They can, and holding on to that is your role. So keeping it up there as an option. What about Gold Celeste and Open Your Eyes? Shall we go there?
Yeah, let's do it.
Do you want to say anything about it?
Yeah, so actually one of my best friends, his girlfriend just randomly, I actually showed them Let It Happen, and then in exchange she showed me this song. And it is just nuts. I love it. They're probably my favorite band right now, actually. And I have this really like deep psychedelic rock vibe, and just love it. Love it.
Here we go. listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and that was Gold Celeste and Open Your Eyes. Our guest on this hour is Micah Green. Micah, you talked about how this this robotic-made floor cleaning device is meant to augment, and that's the work of the cleaning staff in hotels. Is it going to go to restaurants, or is it just in hotels at this point? Or
yeah, we'll focus in on hotels, but definitely other areas. Yeah, yeah, any floors that need cleaning will help
right,
out.
Right, eventually. And so you choose the word augmentation intentionally, and why?
Yeah, so I think, you know, this is a touchy subject, and for the social side, we're right at that cusp of where people are really opening their arms to this. So a lot of these robotics and just automated technologies are really meant or have been meant for back of house, like warehouses, for example, mm-hmm. factories, and, you know, those big arm robots, for example. So this is really, you know, we're one of the first that are really bringing that out into the commercial area. Industrial area outside of back of house or academia, for example.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So there's that fine line you walk, and I think a part of it is we want to improve their life too, you know, not take away from it.
Sure. And I guess, because, you know, part of my background is in economic history, and there's always a tension between things that are taken out of labor's hands and put into capital's hands, and there are things that are, you know, back and forth, and who gets paid and who gets and how does you know, compensation work in all of this, which is part of the human bottom line. How do we value the people in our lives? I think that's a tension that we're all pretty much aware of.
Yeah.
And that's the issue is, well, how do we address it in a way that's fair? But there's another tension here that I think helps to frame the issue almost in keeping with the way the example you gave about, you know, moving from digging with our fingernails to digging with a stick to digging with a shovel or whatever. Most human beings historically got most of their exercise from work. We are out of shape, we are out of whatever, people, and while these cleaning jobs are dangerous, in part because of the repetitive issues and in part because, you know, none of us would, you know, if we were all taking care of our space, we'd all be cleaning our own spaces, and that would work into our daily life. What we may need to have is a broader conversation on how physical activity and work are supposed to go together. Mm-hmm. And which activities should we kind of be able to say, no, I can't do that, or that doesn't fit my body type, or that doesn't fit anybody's body type, and that needs to be taken over robotically. And yet we need to have a certain level of physical exertion, whether we have an intellectual job or a repetitive physical labor job. We need to have some physical exertion into our lives. And,
absolutely.
You know, and we're not balancing that well. And we're overweight and under-exercised and all sorts of stuff as a nation. But that could be a way of reframing the augmentation piece in terms of people actually having good health from their work, along with diet. And we don't tend to think of our lives as something that we create by how we choose to work. I used to choose to live a certain distance from Cornell.
Yep.
Because that was that allowed me to hike.
Yeah.
And I could count on having the minimum amount of exercise every day because I didn't have to go to a gym.
Yeah.
I hate gyms, you know, but as long as I can go and build that into my daily life, I'm happy.
Yeah.
You know, and because my life has changed, now I use a step machine mm-hmm. more, an elliptical rather. Mm-hmm. And that elliptical allows me to augment what I haven't been able to kind of do in my own life. But ideally, our lives would be in sufficient balance that we would get the exercise doing what we normally do.
Yeah, definitely. Have you seen the movie WALL-E?
No.
Oh, no. Okay, yeah. So it's the Pixar movie of the robot that falls in love with the other, like, new robot.
Right.
And essentially, skip over not unimportant parts, but they're all on this giant, like, cruise ship in space, and they all have this one chair that levitates, and everyone has it. And everyone looks super identical, or very similar at least, because they're all very, very large and obese.
Right.
And the idea is that, you know, we're all, they don't walk anymore.
Right.
They're
right.
all on this levitating chair. So it's really the fact that technology I think a key thing people have to remember is technology brings problems. It solves problems, but then it brings problems.
It creates problems.
And it's like the hoverboards too, right? So I think that in the same idea, it's like, just walk. Although I'm not going to lie, I wish I had one a few times because I don't have a car here in Ithaca, but which is a nice way to get exercise,
sure.
You know, walking everywhere. But yeah, with technology comes other problems, like especially around, you know, the physical aspects of it. So
And we don't really fully appreciate it. Your story about how you were raised to have a lot of experiences. I think a lot of times we're kind of headed into to a level of class conflict or a level of misunderstanding that maybe we. It's kind of dangerous. But I grew up in rural poverty, but I grew up with parents who expected us to figure out how to make a structure that we could sit under. Mm-hmm. You know, who figured out, if I wanted to make a tunnel into the side of the clay hill along a creek, you know, I could do it, but they wanted to make sure that I knew about the safety issues around collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to go and read and learn about peoples that I couldn't go visit, but I was encouraged to do that, you know, because even though we didn't have a lot of resources and I worked to help support my family from the time I was 11 years old.
Wow.
And I'm the sixth of seven and we all did something like that.
Wow.
And my two brothers are serial entrepreneurs in their own ways. We were taught that same kind of curiosity and grab every experience you can. And you've been taught it and you've learned it. And what you've done reflects the resources you had to do it, fencing and surf and these other and travel abroad. I mean, I was able to work for almost the same compensation my mother did for much of my middle school and high school years.
Wow.
Because she worked for the minimum wage. And back then it was worth close to $10 or $15 an hour, which meant that you could actually make a difference. So I helped buy the family car. I paid my way to Columbia as South America as an exchange student and had the encouragement and the experiences. And a lot of poor people live just like that.
Yeah.
And we don't see it. And a lot of affluent people don't live with the affluence for the status as much as for the experience, which is what you've defined.
Mm-hmm.
And that's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Though our material conditions are radically different,
mm-hmm.
we can have a similar appreciation and a similar ability to collaborate. And we don't think about that as a culture. And I'm sorry, I've turned this into a sermonette. And I didn't really mean to do that. But my guess is that you haven't spent a lot of time with poor people. But you have spent a lot of time with different people.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, part of that, though, was part of the reason to go to the South American countries is to get that different experience. And I'm not going to lie, I'm very lucky in the way I grew up. And I am very... You know, I was spoiled in that sense, and definitely appreciate that. Yeah. And
I don't see it as spoiled. You used the opportunities you had.
Yeah.
And they didn't deny you, but they also didn't flatter you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is another, a big issue. When I went to Columbia as an exchange student, I stayed with a family that had trained the doctor. There was a physician in the family who trained at Columbia Presbyterian as an ophthalmologist. He was the only ophthalmologist in Pereira, which is a town of about, half a million or a million people at the time. I grew up without manners at the table. I didn't know how to eat properly. I didn't know how to do all this stuff. And so when I arrived there, I actually moved up in social status from where I was in the U.S., because, we raised all the food we ate and we slaughtered the animals and my mom had historically made the clothes. And, this is a stereotypic kind of story.
Yeah.
And then when my dad died, she worked at the minimum wage as a nurse's aide. So when I went to Columbia, I got an exposure to a lifestyle that was much closer to where you were coming from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids there had, they knew English. They were bilingual from mm-hmm. the beginning. And all I'm saying with this is that we need not be sentimental about any of our experiences, but just the more we understand about others, the better.
Yeah.
And I don't hold it against you, and I hope, and I don't, and you don't hold it against me. Our backgrounds, because they give us profound connections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. No, I mean that's why I said earlier. You know, to me, perspective is everything, or maybe not everything, but it's a huge part. And understanding that, and it's really hard to unless you live that. You know, you go through it. You can read books. You can look at, watch movies, and look at articles online, whatever. But really, I mean, it comes down to living it, experiencing it that way. So
And you are on. This is an incredible time of life for you. In terms of, you have taken a leave from Cornell after a year, started a company, you've raised buku resources and supporters to make this happen. How many people work in your organization?
So we have 5 full-time and then 4 part-time right now.
Yeah. And you're 19 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge set of responsibilities and accomplishments.
Mm-hmm. Age is just a number.
Pardon?
I always say age is just a number, and it's all about the passion and what you care about. So.
Well, but also, age is just a number, but also, and the people who want to be part of a startup are kind of a unique breed.
Oh yeah,
because they're willing to risk things that others aren't.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're willing to respond to the motivation in ways that others want to see the bottom line, or they want to see 5-10 years out. And that's, you're not going to get those people, but you have a neat community around you. In your introduction, you said something about yourself that was really fascinating, that you meditate.
Yes.
And all of your musical selections have this meditative quality to them, regardless of how techno rock they are.
I'm a little biased.
So how did you learn that? How did you learn that was important? When did you start?
Yeah, and it is a huge part of my life. So,
and you define that. What is huge? Why is it huge?
Yeah, for sure. So, I guess backing up just to, you know, when I really started with it, it was the idea. I think my dad actually was the one who said, "Let's go. There's a session going on nearby. It's going to be great. We'll try it out. If we hate it, we hate it. Whatever." So, and I've always been fascinated by it, and I looked up articles how to meditate, but really didn't know. So we went to this one session, and I was just very, very intrigued, and I was fascinated with how it was going, and I was trying very hard to do it and failing, because, you know, the idea is to kind of, and maybe you can't fail at meditation per se, but so don't. But
you're an achiever.
Yeah, but in the sense of, like, you know, it felt like I was doing it wrong. I guess not that I knew what was right, but then there's actually a class. So I took 2 amazing classes as a part of my PE credits for Cornell. Uh-huh. One of them was it was water skiing. That was great. And the second was meditation. It was actually a gym class.
Yeah.
So that's what changed my life. And shout out to Priscilla Timberlake, who's the professor, teacher of that. And I think what really got me hooked, and, you know, why it's such a big part of my life, is the fact that, if you think about it, you know, let's say we're up 12 hours, 14 hours a day, right? And then you multiply that out by 60 minutes, 720, you know, 800 minutes, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that we're constantly running around, you know, you wake up, shower, eat, go to work, do this, do that, go back, like watch TV, eat. It's like, how often do we just breathe? Literally just breathe. Like, that's what it comes down to.
Right.
How often? And I was observing people around me, and, you know, in a place like Ithaca, it's a little different because people are typically not stressed out of their mind. At Cornell, I would, you know, I'd differ.
When you're on the hill versus off the hill.
Yeah, exactly. It's a different mentality. But really, you know, it's, and I think that's why I was so intrigued, because I was up on the hill.
Yeah.
So it was nice. But, you know, and like going to New York City, like I'm going to New York City later today, and it's going to be this hustle and, you know, people going crazy and whatnot. So really, it comes down to, how often do we breathe, and why not more so? And just breathe, let loose, sit, and do nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Because that allows your brain to work in different ways. It allows your brain to stop thinking about, oh, this task, that task. Right. I have to talk to this person. I have to call this person. I have to go to the bank, whatever. And it just helps you slow down.
Yeah.
And to me, that's huge and crucial, because if we're constantly going on this, there's that burnout. There's that idea that, you know, we're going to just drive ourselves nuts and be stressed out of our minds.
Right.
And I think, you know, there's a lot of things going on in my life right now, especially we're about to move to Austin, Texas, actually.
Wow.
Move the whole company and trying to figure that out. But I think throughout this whole process, even throughout, like, you know, negatives happening in the business or my life, because I have this slow, this element of slowing down, and I do it every day, not more than 10, 20 minutes, but it helps. And it helps just bring a different sort of, again, perspective to life. So
I want to come back to this, but I want to get in two more pieces of music in this hour, because the last two pieces are yours.
Awesome.
Which one would you like to go to next?
Let's do Nigel.
Okay.
A little different vibe than the other guys.
Yeah. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this hour is Micah Green, and that was a piece by Micah and one of his friends. So tell me about music in your life. That seems to have been a big part.
Yeah, definitely. So it's interesting because growing up, I my parents always played music in the car, and my brother was very, very into music. But I'd say for some reason, I just wasn't really that engaged, and I didn't have a favorite band. I didn't really listen to music that much. And then I went to California, and that was a pivotal point for a lot of things. But for the music side, one of my best friends there that really, you know, kind of helped me get comfortable in California showed me a few of his favorite songs. It was this group of Montreal, and I just, you know, started listening to a little more, and I realized that there's this whole world out there that I just didn't know about. And I mean, it was there and it was so accessible. And, you know, this, we have internet and all these other YouTube to easily access all of this. And I wasn't taking advantage of it. And I just felt like, you know, music was okay. It's, you know, just music, whatever. But to me now, it's a whole other element. It's that therapeutic side. It's the meditative side. That's why I think a lot of the songs are, do kind of fall under that umbrella. Sure. But then I would say in ninth grade is when I went to really like the first concert. So my parents took me to concerts. We went to like the Beach Boys and some other great ones, but a little older, I'd say, for the older demographic. Not that I don't love them. They're awesome. But then when I got more engaged in music, one of my best friends back in Maryland when we moved back was absolutely obsessed with music. I mean, he, since he was young, just always, and I just didn't get it. But once I came back, I was like, you know, you want to teach me some stuff? He was the one that introduced me to Tame Impala. And really, I think it was just this whole other world out there. And then we went to some concerts together and I was just like, I need to do that. I need to be able to do that. Like just play music and create. It's like that same kind of the umbrella of entrepreneurship, like I said before, creating something and like creating community around that. Mm-hmm. So to me, that was a phenomenal like experience, just going to a concert and being a part of that community to support the band. And then thinking about how it would be on the band's perspective, right, you know, bringing that to people. So I got one of those little MIDI keyboards. Uh-huh. So it plugs into your computer, super sure. easy. And I did actually, not going to lie, my dad did have us all take piano lessons when I was younger.
Sure.
And then I took guitar for like a little bit for months. But we did that when we were younger, just creating that foundation. That being said, it was years later that I really started playing again. And I don't consider myself like a piano player, keyboard player. I say that I just pretend like I know what I'm doing. Uh-huh. And if it sounds good, then I'll just stick with that. Stick with those chords. So it brings just a different side. It's part of that, like, you know, entrepreneurial spirit, I guess you could say, and building something and creating something of value to at least myself, at least, and then from nothing, from scratch. And it brings this whole creative element to it, and something that's just so unique to a lot of other things out there today. Mm-hmm. And so, side note, I went to South by Southwest recently and went to this panel on AI. So artificial intelligence, yes, just in case. And so, you know, after going to that, I was biased because I love robots, love automation, love AI. And I went up after them and their goal is to develop algorithms to create a superhuman, not a human, not something capable of being a human, but a human or a robot that it's actually able to be, to have, understand full emotion, you can pump in different intelligence. So literally pumping in Wikipedia and then just having conversations with us. But anyway, I went up after because I was curious, what about AI around music? Has anyone created algorithms to create music? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this guy is like a genius AI like programmer and has developed many different systems that a ton of people use today. And he said that it's one of the hardest things because music brings this peace that automation can't necessarily, and they're working on it, but there's this strong emotional factor into it that is really hard to quantify with data, with numbers, with math. So really it was, you know, really intriguing to me because people are trying it. There's literally a guy in Austin, Texas right now, he said that they're working with, who is right now, his goal is to create music from like algorithms using or music using algorithms and that sort of stuff. And really, it's just so fascinating because it's that mix of like the automation, robotic side, but with trying to bring it into this more emotional, unique space.
Mm-hmm. And why, I guess, I can see the connection. I can see the reach out. When you talk about having discovered music, it seemed to kind of resonate with your whole body in a way that maybe the meditation has now come to do that as well. And that's, is it a profound curiosity and wanting to push what the limits are that take you into music and robotics? Or is it a sense that they will bring something back to us? You know, we'll discover something different about ourselves. What is the motivation to link music and robotics?
Yeah.
For you.
That's an interesting question. I'd say it's kind of a mix of those things in a sense. So I love pushing the limits and doing things that make me feel uncomfortable because it's usually making me grow and helping me gain that other perspective. And then there's that side of bringing back and, you know, wanting to create something that is useful. And it's hard to say that music is useful per se, but it is in terms of, you know, getting people, whether it's helping them sleep or helping them feel better or helping whatever it might be, helping them dance in some cases.
Well, so. Or sometimes music is like a mirror. I can see if the tone of the song is one of kind of a sweet sadness, all of a sudden I realize I'm feeling sweetly sad about something happened a long time ago.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, or it helps to me to know better where I am. It's like those little faces with the different emotions on them sometimes.
Yeah.
You can, oh, that's, I'm the feeling emojis, coy right now, or I'm feeling, you know, sly or whatever.
Exactly.
You know?
Definitely. And that's a huge part. You really connect with it. So I think that is huge. And so we create these dance songs and we love, you know, dance. And I hope, I think it'd be amazing to be able to have people, and we've played it before live for like little concerts and stuff.
Sure.
To have people dance and really be about it and excited. But we also started a side project for psychedelic rock. And this is a lot more of that emotional, less like, you know, dancey upbeat, and just more of that like mellow and bringing you to that. So it's, you know, bringing you to the mentality of, you know, like connecting with more with the music, I'd say, than just dancing. You know, it's a more of a intimate experience. And I think it's an experience. I think music is as a whole an experience. And each artist brings their own take, and there's no artist that's the same, although some sound very similar.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's powerful.
Yeah, no. I think I would agree with you on that very much so. What I want to go back to the meditation piece and also into the future. When do you know you need to take time to meditate? Those 10 to 20 minutes. What happens in your life or in the day where you know you need to do that?
I finish brushing my teeth and I'm in my boxers. Go back into my bedroom, and I always do it right before I go to bed.
So you have a schedule that you...
Yeah, and so, you know, my day-to-day follows somewhat of a, you know, high-level schedule, but the thing about meditation, which is crucial, which is kind of ironic, because meditation is trying to keep you away from this, you know, day-to-day to-do, but the ironic piece is that you should have a schedule for meditation because it allows you to avoid making excuses. Oh, it's just meditation. You know, I can, I'm just gonna go to bed. I'm really tired. That sort of stuff. And that's why sometimes, you know, I've been doing meditation in the mornings too. But I think it's really important that if you want to try meditation or if you start it, doing it very consistently, even if it's for 2 minutes at 9 p.m. every night. And it doesn't even have to be the same time. It's just, you know, when you get home. Like last night, for example, it was 2 a.m. The night before, it was 3 a.m. So it really just like depends. And it's, you know, important. And now it's interesting because in terms of like my workload, it's been getting ridiculous in terms of, you know, we're shifting over to Austin, like all this stuff is happening. And I've been way, way more engaged in my meditation. Like it's been longer than usual. And I think part of that is because, you know, it's, you don't want to be reactive with meditation, but in a sense, it is kind of being more reactive at this stage than proactive. Although, you know, I'm always going to do it, but I have so much more in my mind that I feel more engaged and more, it's like more necessary.
And
to
you
me.
Need to step back.
Yeah, it's what, more essential.
I learned to meditate on a leave of absence from Cornell.
Interesting.
In the summer of 1979. And I meditated for an hour in the morning and an hour at night. This was back in the day when they thought it was important to do it longer. But when I did it for that for 2.5 to 3 months with that kind of discipline, I stopped. And I've never done it on a disciplined schedule. But every time I straighten my spine and I breathe deeply, I can immediately go back into that meditative space. And then I can do it if I need it. But I discover in the same way that you do that as the stress gets higher, I need that. Because the minute I breathe deeply, the release comes. And then I can begin to let go. And I need to take time and acknowledge that.
Yeah. And I think what's so cool about meditation is the fact that you don't need to buy anything. You don't need to be anywhere specific.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's good to be in similar places to do it consistently. But for example, if you're going on a flight, and I've done this before, meditate in your seat, meditate in the waiting area, meditate. And another thing is, you know, there's meditation outside of just sitting and meditating. There's, you know, let's say you're waiting for a bus and you're stressing out. And I've done this before. Like, you know, you're really like, you're right on the cusp and you have to meet with somebody and you're going to be 10 minutes late, but you want, you know, you want to be 5 minutes early and you're kind of freaking out. So to avoid that, you just walk back and forth and meditate. And it's just, it's like a tool in a sense that you can use anywhere for free without anything. You could be in, you know, a completely different part of the world with nothing but your clothes, and you could still meditate.
Right. How do you hold other people's concerns for you? You're very young. You're handling large amounts of money. You're handling large, you're handling people's lives in a concept that is pretty, you know, tricky to handle. How do you handle people's judgments about you should be in college, or what are you going to do if this fails? Or how do you manage that kind of feedback? Or do you get it? Do people hit you with it?
Yeah, usually I just run away at that point. I'm just kidding. Run away from them so I don't have to avoid, or so I can avoid it. No. It's definitely interesting because it's completely different with different people, and sometimes surprisingly so.
Right, right.
Where some of the more entrepreneurial people I know are like, you should be back in school. You should be doing, which is really interesting. Like some of my mentors just through Rev, where we work, are like, what, you know, I started a company when I was in school. And it's like, okay, and I totally respect that, and you killed it, and it's amazing. But, you know, for me in this space, it's not necessarily apples to apples, right?
Right.
So, and then, you know, friends and other people who might not know much about entrepreneurship or that sort of stuff, they're like, hell yeah, like, what you're doing is amazing, you know, you should be out of school. Someone told me a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't know how to take this, they're like, you know, I never saw you as a school person. Like, okay, I guess that's a compliment, I don't know.
Yeah.
But
so you take these comments lightly, not as strong judgments you have to respond to.
Yeah, so I think one skill that I've learned, I don't know if it's a skill per se, but I talk to a ton of people all the time. I mean, I have like maybe anywhere from like 7 to 10 meetings a day, like calls, meetings, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of that is getting feedback. So a lot of just the day-to-day for me is talking to potential investors, getting feedback, talking to mentors, advisors. I was lucky enough to speak to the founder of Guitar Hero the other day to give me advice on our company. And there's something called mentor whiplash. And that's the idea that, you know, you get so much advice that a lot is going to be contradictory to each other.
Right.
So they don't necessarily agree. And that's where you have to make the judgment who's right, and maybe they're both wrong.
They're both right and they contradict each other.
Exactly. Which is then you're like, what am I doing with my life? Head explodes. I think, you know, it's that I think I'm lucky in the sense that I hear so much advice that I've learned how to deal with it. I'm always open. I'm never going to reject someone's idea right off the bat because that's not fair.
Yeah.
Unless I've thought deeply about it and totally like, no,
which has happened. Them. They know but, you've engaged.
But yeah, and you know, proving that out. But still, I think, you know, you have to be whatever people say, you're the one that decides who's right, even if, you know, you think they're wrong. So just being very respectful, listening, I think I've become a very good listener through that, and just responding to it in a very respectful yet, you know, bold way in my own sense, because I can do with that what I want.
Yes, and to me, that's much more important answer to hear than where you think you're going to be 10 years from now, because that's the approach with which you are engaging life.
Mm-hmm.
Micah, it's been really good to get to know you.
Yeah, thanks so much. This has been fun.
And we're going to close with one of your songs. Thank you.